You are listening to The Exchange. Today we're going to talk a little more about what's going on with COVID-19 around the state and here in Sioux City. And to that end, I have Tyler Brock, the Deputy Director and Director of Lab Services at Siouxland District Health on the line. Hello, Tyler.
Hello.
Hey, it's good to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks for tuning or checking in with us today.
Well, yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you what was going on in terms of COVID-19 cases in Woodbury County. The last I heard, there were only two.
Correct. We're still at two. We have not had any new cases the last 2 days, and we are thankful for that, although we fully expect to get more cases as test results come in. There are quite a few tests that are out there still pending results. But we're at two right now, and we'll be satisfied with that right now. In the state continues to see increases, as we might expect. I think the governor announced another 21 cases across the state today, and so that's really where we find ourselves right now.
Do we know how these cases were transmitted here in Woodbury County? Were these people, had they been traveling, or was it a community thing?
There were travel situations in both cases. So it's not 100% sure that's how they got it. But if you told me I had to say, I would say that these are travel related cases.
Does that make you feel better?
At this point, the virus is circulating in Iowa. And so it doesn't make me feel a lot better, frankly, because we know that the virus is around, that people are able to get it, and that's why we've implemented all this social distancing and personal hygiene kind of thing. Does it maybe say something about the fact that, you know, so far it hasn't seemed like it's widespread here in Siouxland? Of course, I'll take some comfort in that. But we know that the virus is around. We know it's circulating, and so we're operating under that assumption.
A lot of us have friends that have not been feeling well, and they say, "Well, I would like to get a test, but so far my doctor has said he doesn't think that I need a test." I guess meaning that the symptoms aren't so bad or so prevalent, and that is this still a matter of not enough tests to go around?
No, I think the doctors are, in a lot of cases, just using their judgment on whether a test is medically indicated. All the testing still should be medically indicated. There's tests available for those that need it the most. And I think in a lot of these cases, the doctors are just using their judgment that this does not appear to be COVID-19, and so it's not medically indicated to test for COVID-19.
When you look around the community, just driving around, you know, yesterday it was nice out and I saw a bunch of kids in the neighborhood out riding their bikes and people walking their dogs and people at the park. And I guess, you know, people need to get out to some extent. Have you noticed people still sort of trying to have that social distance from each other, though? I know I didn't see a lot of people congregating, so I guess that's good.
Yeah, I guess I can't speak to that too much. You know, I get around town just a little bit, but we're not really driving around seeing, you know, looking for folks and that kind of a thing. Mostly, you know, we kind of know what you see and what the public sees as well, that, yeah, there's people out and about doing some outdoor things, and that's okay. That's okay in most cases. As long as you're not sick, there's no reason you can't go for a walk in your dog or, you know, go ride your bike and things like that. We're really wanting to focus on those larger groups, the group gatherings, trying to still keep some distance between us and other folks. I think the gatherings and things like that have been cut way down in the community.
I've heard a lot about these do-it-yourself tests in like the national press conferences. Are those a real thing? Are they going to be around?
I guess I wouldn't be super surprised if that happens. Kind of what we in the laboratory world we call that point of care testing, and so it tends to be a lot simpler test. You know, something that you can do at a bedside or at home or something like that. So I won't be surprised if some of those tests become available at some point. There's a lot of smart folks that know how to build these kinds of things, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if somebody comes up with something to do that with. But for now, the tests that we have are what we've got, and we'll see what comes down the road with new technology.
Seems like there's a lot of concern in certain, you know, hot spots in the country: New York, Southern California, up in Washington State, some parts in Illinois, and down in Texas. Now here, it really, and I don't know, it's like a false sense of security maybe. It doesn't feel like it's that bad. And I've heard of, you know, people with friends on the East Coast who are trying to come back to the Midwest where it's not so bad. Do you think it's easy to kind of have that false sense of security? Because, you know, I mean, here in Woodbury County, we have two people. But still, I mean, it's out there, right?
Yeah, it probably is out. It's out there, probably in a little bit higher numbers than what's been confirmed at this point. That probably is true. But one thing that I think it benefits us to understand the differences in geography and the differences in places. Like, for instance, I was just doing a little bit of research yesterday, and New York City has 3 million people living in 302 square miles, and you know, Woodbury County has approximately 100,000 people spanned over 878 square miles. So there's an enormous population density in New York City that we can't even fathom that hardly. And so when you pile people on top of each other, things are going to get magnified. We're a little bit more spread out here, and so that is going to help us. Now, again, it can't give us a complete false sense of security, like, oh, it can't happen here, because we know it's going to and that it is. But we should be able to understand the differences between our areas and some of the metro areas, like especially New York City stands out, and how that's different from our geography and the number of people that are piled on top of each other.
I know that the public health department sends out messages in English, and I've seen some in Spanish. It seems like you've been really trying to reach out to the immigrant community.
Yes, we. I mean, we are. I guess I would be. I wish we could do more, and we're working on that all the time. But we are making efforts to make sure that folks that English isn't their first language, that we can get those messages out to them as well. So it's something that we're striving for, and you know, just if there's anyone out there that wants to lend a hand in that effort, we would be interested in talking to them. But yeah, the effort's definitely there.
You know, on the other side of the state, in Cedar Rapids, they have volunteer opportunities that they say you can sew masks for the hospitals. You know, it really is amazing the number of things people can do. I mean, I haven't heard of that around here yet, but it does seem like there are a lot of ways people can help without sort of, you know, hurting anybody.
Yeah, I think a lot of communities are really trying to tap into the awesome resources that our citizens provide. You know, there's lots of talents and gifts out there, and there's a lot of ways that folks can help. And so that's being done all around the state. It's being done here. It's being done around the country as well. So I think there's a lot of that. My guess is we'll be seeing a lot more as we move forward.
Well, Tyler, thank you so much for talking with us. So we'll check in with you again.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Tyler Brock. He is the Deputy Director of Lab Services at Siouxland District Health. And thanks to Tyler. Now, Congress is ready to pass an estimated $2 trillion stimulus package aimed at combating the economic consequences of the coronavirus pandemic, just hours after legislative leaders in the Trump administration struck a deal. Now, the Senate plans to vote on that bill today. The legislation will provide direct financial checks to many Americans, drastically expand unemployment insurance, offer hundreds of billions of dollars in loans to small and large businesses, and extend additional resources to health care providers. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters today she is optimistic about that bill and said no decision had been made about when the House would try and take up the legislation if it clears the Senate today, as expected. Now, Iowa's 4th District Congressman Steve King says he voted against an earlier version of the bill, along with many other House Republicans, because the requirements on small businesses were, he said, onerous. King says he's still concerned those provisions could be in the bill, and the measure still could be loaded with measures to implement things like Green New Deal items rather than the coronavirus.
Since the language that passed the House that I voted against was language that required any business with 500 or fewer employees to pay full pay for the first 2 weeks that any employee would be absent from work and in the first 2 weeks of a coronavirus impact. And then the following, it was 90 days required pay altogether, and the following, the rest of the days was at two-thirds pay. Well, that would break most of the, I'll say many of the small businesses. I don't know about most. And so that was far too onerous a requirement, and it was not thought through. It was just thrown at us. And I did hear from a lot of small businesses that said, this breaks me. I can't even hope to keep my doors open with this standard. And so what we ended up with in a technical correction was to allow for a waiver for the employer to apply for a waiver to be waived from those onerous requirements, and then also reduce that number down to employees, or excuse me, an employee number of 50 rather than 500.
I know a lot of Republicans have been, in the Senate, John Kennedy of Louisiana has talked a lot about some of the things that have been put in the stimulus package that seem to not have much to do with COVID-19. Is that a concern of yours?
Well, it certainly is, and I don't see how I could vote for a bill that had some of these things in it, like the components, and I don't think it's the whole Green New Deal, but some components of that, and that would be requiring airline carriers to fully offset carbon emissions for domestic flights by 2025. That is not an emergency approach. That's a wish list that's been out there for a long time. And then to require them to provide passengers with information regarding greenhouse gas emissions. What's that in there for if we're concerned about an emergency situation? It just is, you know, it's throwing wrenches into the gears of government, at least the legislation. And then requiring the Department of Transportation to study climate change mitigation efforts. That's another one that's clearly a wish list. And all of those are out of the Green New Deal. And then inserting a minimum wage of $15 an hour. That's a labor piece, and there's advantages written into this, the wish list, to give more leverage to union negotiations as well. And
do you think things have been too partisan in trying to get this done?
I had hoped that they wouldn't be partisan, and the tone of the Iowa delegation seems to be nonpartisan. But when Speaker Pelosi started this week out with a whole package of wish lists that she threw into the mix over in the Senate, just as the Senate was ready to pass a bill, that looks partisan to me, especially it's a wish list of a progressive agenda. And this bill needs to be, it's big enough right now as we speak, is my understanding, we're about $1.8 trillion. And it's big enough. It doesn't need to have any more weight added to it. It should be stripped down to those things that are necessary to give confidence to the economy, to get us to the maximum amount of safety for our people and get us back to work as soon as we practically can. And anything outside that should be stripped out of the bill. And we should also keep in mind that, you know, this isn't like a one-shot only situation. This is the third bite at the apple, by the way, and there will be others. So I'm not suggesting that we try to put all the solutions in place for the long term. I suggest instead that about 30 days out is as far as we can maybe actually have a vision to see what might be unfolding. And we should expect that we'll be going back to address this and deal with this on a periodic basis. And I suggest and recommend that we do that. Let's be prudent about it, and let's not jump too far ahead.
It seems to be on one side you have people saying, well, If we don't go back to business in America soon, it's going to ruin the economy. And the other side says, well, if you rush to judgment and put everything back at once, more people will die. It seems like there has to be somewhere in the middle for this.
And I agree that there isn't a quick solution to this, and neither should we set ourselves up for a long and prolonged approach to this, but we have to be ready in case it takes that. And I want to listen to the experts on health for sure first. That's the first thing. save as many lives as we can and minimize the infection rate early, especially to flatten that curve, as everybody's talking about now.
That was 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King of Chiron talking about the coronavirus stimulus package in the Senate. King believes there are too many unrelated items in the bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she wanted to add in more items in the stimulus bill that would directly benefit workers and not industry. The stimulus bill now goes back to the House for consideration, and if it passes there, then it goes to President Trump, who says he will likely sign it. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, a lot of colleges and universities in Iowa and around the Midwest have canceled in-person classes for the rest of this year. And now Morningside College has announced it will shift its online coursework for the remainder of its spring semester due to concerns over the spread of COVID-19. According to an update that Morningside President John Rinder sent students today, there will be no in-person courses, and all May term classes have been canceled. Any junior or senior who hasn't completed a May term before graduating will also have that requirement waived. So that's yet another college getting on that bandwagon of having no more in-person classes this year, at least this term. And before the threat of the new coronavirus, the biggest concern in school districts is usually how do you make up snow days? Snow days, though, are nothing compared to the current reality facing students, staff, and teachers and administrators. The head of the Sioux City Community School District, Superintendent Paul Gosman, gives us more information about what the area's biggest school district is facing right now. He starts his conversation with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer by answering a question about the potential for students staying home for the rest of this school year.
It's hard to say right now. You know, we're certainly set on coming back on April 14th right now, which is what the governor originally recommended. Certainly, we've seen a lot of states like Kansas and I believe even some districts in Nebraska who have basically canceled for the rest of the year. So I guess we wouldn't be shocked if our 4-week time was extended, but there's no guarantee that will happen right now. Currently, we're planning to start on April 14th.
What will happen with the school year? I know we've read that it'll be the same out if you go back on April 14th. What happens if the school year is completely canceled?
Right. So, yeah, first of all, the governor has given us permission to waive the days. She hasn't required that we do waive the days, but all the information I have from our local school board and certainly my own decision would be to do just that, meaning that if we started again on April 14th, we would not try to make up that extra month in June or something like that. And if we are in a situation where the remainder of the school year is canceled, we have some real work to do to discover and figure out how to, you know, confer diplomas upon those students who have earned enough credits to receive those. This challenge is really difficult for the class of 2020. A lot of the things we all remember, maybe even fondly, maybe not, but those rites of passage that we go through in high school, they're missing out on so many of those because, of course, they happen in the spring semester of your senior year. And so we're working diligently right now to discover exactly where each of our, we've got about 1,000 graduates, each of those graduates will be so that we can do what we need to do to get them onto the next phase of their life.
What about the other grades and the other classes?
Yeah, it's a challenge. If you think about it, my biggest concern in addition to the seniors, the class of 2020, really lies in the earliest grades, the first grade, second grade school years. If you think about a reader, someone learning how to read in first grade, that second semester of that first grade year is pivotal to their success. And, they go from really knowing sounds and letters and those sorts of things in early first grade to really being able to read by the end of first grade. And so I think if we lose the rest of the school year, it will have a long-term effect on achievement. Certainly something that our staff is prepared for, and they're experts, and they'll do a great job of bringing where they need to be when they get time with the students.
And you're talking about my daughter. She's 6. She is in that first grade, second semester. So what kind of advice would you give not only, me as a parent, but other parents out there? We're getting guidance from some of the teachers. They're sending out information to us. But what would you tell parents? What should they be doing with their children right now? Should they be working hard with classes, or should they just be maybe comforting them now through this kind of difficult and unknown time?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, and I'm glad to hear from you as a parent of our district that that the staff members are reaching out and giving you some direction, some ideas. You know, that's very important to us, and so, you know, I'm thankful to our school board who have decided that our staff members will be paid during this shutdown, and what that's allowed us to do is to say to the staff members, we understand you may be at home, but because we're being paid, let's do what we can to work together and try and help through this challenge. And so I think it's very important for all parents and guardians of children to spend a certain amount of time each day with their children to prep them for and to engage the children in some learning activities. You know, our typical school day is about 6.5 hours, and certainly I don't think that, you know, everybody needs to spend 6.5 hours a day when they're not in school on academic items, although that wouldn't be the worst thing. But if people could dedicate somewhere, you know, between 2 and 4 hours a day where they're really working individually and diligently on those things that the staff members have called to share. Also, we have put up a number of resources on our website. Iowa is a little different than Nebraska and South Dakota. You know, we're here in the tri-state neighborhood. Our state has not yet allowed us to do online learning as an absolute mandate. Or take-home learning is an absolute mandate.
Do you think there should be that kind of learning, and why has the state not decided to do it?
Oh, sure. It certainly would be nice to be able to do a lot of digital and online learning right now. And I'm not criticizing our state in any way about that. You know, we're a district that is fairly high in poverty compared to many others. And so we still have a fair percentage, larger than 10%, I'm sure, of our student population that does not have internet access at home. And so, you know, the state's position rightfully has been about what the federal law refers to as FAPE, or Free Appropriate Public Education, FAPE. And the point behind that is, whatever you offer to one student, you absolutely must be able to offer to every single student. And Iowa just acknowledges that we may not have enough devices or internet connectivity for every single student. We might not have the person power to get out and offer special education services, English second language services, to all students in the district, because we typically work with them in groups when they're in the schools. And so, you know, certainly in the future, I think we'll do more and more online learning. A lot of people have asked me about high school. You know, we're very well set up at high school for online learning, and we could do all of our high school instruction online. Now, I would want to say, in my opinion, as an expert in education, there is no replacement for a high-quality teacher. And so, you know, online instruction is good. In-person with an expert teacher is far better. And so I don't think that we'll get to a point where when we don't have a crisis of this sort and we can gather in larger groups, that we'll get rid of, in-person instruction and education. But I do see how, online learning certainly would be of great benefit here and in this situation, but only for certain groups of our students. Because as an example, we're a district, even with 15,000 students, where all of our sixth graders through 12th graders have their own device. But at our elementary grades, we're not quite there yet. And as you might imagine, a high schooler can log in and do their work and kind of self-direct, where a first grader, even if they're on a computer, you know, they're going to need an adult sitting with them to help them, you know, get into the activity, understand it, and complete it. So there are all kinds of things at play here.
And you were talking about students in poverty. You actually launched a food program. You have 20 or more locations in the district. Are you seeing a big need? Are people showing up for these different food pickup sites?
Yeah, so we began serving last Wednesday, talking to you on Tuesday, and we didn't serve over the weekend. I think there are some other agencies that are going to step up and do that, but right now the district is only able to serve on weekdays. At the time I'm talking to you, and we haven't served yet today, so Wednesday through this Monday, we've served over 15,000 meals, and so it's obvious that there's a real need for that. You know, in the summer, Sheila, we have about 15 different locations in the summer, We serve meals on a daily basis at no cost to the participants, and we typically serve about 1,000 or 1,500 meals a day. Since we have started this program in this time of crisis and need, we've been serving in excess of 4,000, almost 5,000 meals a day, and I think that will only grow as more people become aware of the system. And really what it is, it's in 24 locations in our community. Many of them are school sites, but some of them are not. Some of them are city parks and that sort of thing. And the system is set up so that there's enough social distancing as they come to pick up their food. And children may come, and I know we've had people ask us, well, why are you having children come out in this? Why not have adults? Well, the federal meal program is set up so that we serve children, not adults. And so any child ages 1 through 18 can come, and of course, if they're at that younger age with a parent, and receive each day a sealed bag that has a breakfast in it and a sealed bag that has a lunch in it. And they may do that each weekday. And, we do anticipate that we'll end up serving somewhere in the range of 8,000 meals a day or greater as this program continues through the shutdown.
Are there some of your students that you worry about when it comes to the situation that they might have at home? Because a lot of time they get their comfort by going to schools in some cases.
Yeah, and I don't mean to sound flip in any way, but as a school superintendent, you worry about each and every child every day. And so, there are people who refer to certain students, troubled kids, or certain kids as at-risk kids. And when I think, which kids are at risk, all of them are. And which kids are talented and gifted, all of them are. They've all got good things that are happening in their lives, and they've all got some things that are challenges. And so we want to do everything we can to take care of all of their needs. And you're correct in that, some of the students that any district serves, whether it's a private district or a public district, the school is the safest place and the most comforting place for them, and we certainly acknowledge that they're not able to receive that at this time. But I think with the resources and the partnership that we've seen come out of this crisis, the resources that are on our website, our teachers and staff members continuing to contact the families, I think we can mitigate some of those challenges that are there. And so I continue to just celebrate the great staff members that we have, many of them who are already reaching out and connecting with their students before we even ask them to be doing so with some structure. And so we're really blessed to be here in the Midwestern part of the United States in a great community where everybody really does look out for one another.
And that superintendent of the Sioux City Community Schools, Dr. Paul Gosman, talking about the potential for students to be out the rest of the school year, tips for parents, and a food program available for children living in the district. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, because of concerns surrounding the coronavirus, Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate has pushed back the date of a special election for a Woodbury County supervisor. Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, a Republican, stepped down after residency issues earlier this year. Two candidates are vying for that seat. Democratic State Representative Tim Cassina and Republican Justin Wright, a teacher at North High School, they'll face off in an election that has been pushed back from April to July 7th. Woodbury County Election Commissioner Pat Gill talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about what it means for other races this election season.
The unfortunate thing is that we mailed out absentee ballot request forms to every active voter in Woodbury County, and they received them over the weekend. So that has generated a lot of phone calls, and people are asking what they are to do at this point. And so what we are encouraging voters to do is to fill out those absentee ballot request forms and mail them to us, and we will fulfill those requests and mail a ballot to the voters in Woodbury County starting later this week. Ballots that are voted and returned to us, we will store securely, and they will be counted on Election Day. Those ballots that voters have, they have to be returned to us by July 6th, postmarked by that date, or hand-delivered to our office by the close of polls on July 7th. We are in the process of installing a ballot box outside the courthouse, so people will be able to just pull up there and drop them in that ballot box if they choose not to mail those. The request forms that we mailed out to them are a business reply mail, so there's no cost to the voter to simply fill that out and sign it and send it to us. They'll be able to return it postage free to our office.
Eventually, you'll actually have a couple of polling places available as well, potentially, or depending on how things play out.
What we're still focused on trying to protect our pool of precinct election officials, which come from the folks that are considered most vulnerable to the coronavirus. And so we are limiting polling places. We also are required to have in-person absentee voting. And at this point, the Board of Supervisors has restricted access to the Woodbury County Courthouse as by appointment only. And we are just asking folks to please just fill out their request form and try to send them a ballot and they can vote it at home. We just want to protect our staff and the voters themselves from exposure to the virus.
Are you also protecting yourself when it comes to the virus?
We are training our staff to be diligent in their efforts to limit their exposure too. We've implemented efforts to keep the office nice and clean, and we've supplied them with gloves in order to handle the request forms and the ballots that they will be sending out. We feel pretty good about the plan that we've had. We've been fortunate. The Board of Supervisors allows us to mail out the request forms to voters in order to facilitate that process, and this will work really well for the voters of Woodbury County. We know that we've been reading the reports nationwide that folks are encouraging local election officials to administer their elections vote by mail. We feel like we are a step ahead of the game as far as that goes. The law doesn't allow us to mail ballots directly to voters in Iowa, but with the request forms and the way the process that we've been using, we feel very fortunate. We're on the path to make it a successful election, even if I have to do it by vote at home.
What would happen if this stretches out for months and could potentially impact November? Is this something that you're thinking ahead on as well?
Absolutely. During this period of time, we're planning on running our primary election, which is June 2nd, trying to keep people from being confused, but we plan on running the primary election in the same manner that we're handling this special election. At the beginning of May, we will do another mailing for the primary election and encourage people to do the same thing, is to vote at home during that period of time. And we are working with the Secretary of State's office to determine how we can limit polling place access and in-person voting for that election also.
Are you worried that maybe that will impact some people's ability to get out and vote, or do you think the mailing will help handle all those concerns?
Our experience has been that people who vote at home find it a good way to participate in the election, and it really limits a lot of the barriers. Folks that need accessible equipment to cast their ballot, we will provide that opportunity to them here in the courthouse by appointment only, but we do want people who have a difficult time doing it by mail, we will provide an opportunity for them to cast their ballot. You know, it's a good opportunity for people to participate. I believe it's the most responsible thing that our office can do, and I think that voters will appreciate in the long run. We're just asking for their cooperation in order to cast their ballot and make sure that their opinion has been voiced.
That was Woodbury County Election Commissioner Pat Gill talking to Siouxland Public Media Sheila Brummer about changes with the upcoming elections due to COVID-19 concerns. The special election for county supervisor takes place July 7th. The winner will serve out the remainder of Jeremy Taylor's term that runs through the end of 2022. And right now on the exchange, we're going to check in with Gia Emery of the Blue Cafe in the Conservatory of Music. Gia, I hear that you've been doing a lot of takeout business. Is that right?
Yes, we've been getting some orders. We've had a lot of support from some of our regular customers. And, you know, it was so neat because even with this, hurdle that we're trying to overcome, we have met new customers online, and we're just hoping to get to meet them someday in person. So we've been really, you know, with grateful hearts, considerate of everything that we have to take into consideration, but you know, just doing the best that we can. And I'm just thankful that Kay, that you guys have wanted to talk to me about this.
Have you been able to keep a lot of your staff on?
I'm sorry?
Have you been able to keep your staff working?
The staff is in Blue Cafe. I am the And granted, I really love to work with some of our farmers, like Paradigm Farms. They give me my microgreens for the menu. And then at the conservatory, our staff is really productive in that we are teaching our lessons via FaceTime. We're using our Zoom app for some group lessons. And we've got a new app that we're going to be developing this next week that's going to be in place after we open up again, because there's so many good little platforms within the app for to study at home.
So you're hanging in there.
Most of my students at the conservatory have really felt the need to take a journey with their music study. And I'm just thankful that our staff is positive and feeling the need to reach out to them as well. And we're doing what we can. And, I just can't tell you how thankful we are that we're still in this community with everybody seems in my world to be taking pretty to heart and being responsible the measures we should be taking.
Well, Gia, thanks so much for checking in with us. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much for all the great food. We appreciate it. And that was Gia Emery of the Blue Cafe, the Conservatory of Music. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. Well, the COVID-10 pandemic has forced many local government and groups to find creative ways to conduct official business. The Sioux City Council met for the first time in the current future, the present, with no community members there on Monday. We'll continue to do so till further notice. Council member Alex Waters chose to attend that meeting remotely. He's in self-isolation and shares his thoughts on the new coronavirus and the state's response with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. She reached him by phone the day after the council meeting.
I made the decision really out of an abundance of caution, just trying to be as safe as possible. My body doesn't handle respiratory issues very well. I don't have the muscle structure in my lungs that I once did. And so when I get hit with those respiratory viruses and things like that, it can really affect me in a profound way. And so I just, out of abundance of caution, just wanted to distance myself, practice that physical distancing as much as possible. So I chose to phone in my vote. We didn't have anything extraordinary on the agenda that I felt warranted a physical presence, but I made sure to do all my homework prior to the meeting, had city staff answer some of my concerns, and then called in for the meeting itself.
If some people don't know your history, can you explain a little bit about yourself to people who may not know you, Alex?
Yeah, definitely. So when I was 18 years old, I was a couple weeks into my freshman year at college, at Morningside College there in Sioux City, and had a diving accident where I dove into 18 inches of water and then ultimately became a quadriplegic. And so with that limited ability to use not only my limbs and extremities, but also the lung capability. You know what I mean? A portion of your lungs become paralyzed, and I can't cough as effectively to expel some of that as I once was. So I've taken my Pneumovax and really stay up on my flu shot and try to take preventative measures. I have a regular diet of vitamin C, especially during flu season. But for me, this is something that I just need to be as cautious as possible. I've been working remotely from home. I now work at Morningside College. And so I've been working from home for more than a week now and really been isolating as much as possible and trying to practice those measures outlined by the CDC.
You're using a lot of caution. Do you think the community is using the caution that they should be using? I know there are concerns. I had a friend over the weekend who said she saw parking lots at shopping centers that looked like Christmas.
Yeah. I have a lot of concern. I think that depending on where you're getting your information and what you would choose to believe and different things like that, everyone is entitled to their personal freedoms, right? But I think that some people are taking this very seriously, and some people with a compromised immune system or maybe elderly loved ones, they're thinking about them and willing to make those personal sacrifices. And others really don't see it as much of a threat, or maybe they hear that, oh, it's similar to the common cold or a flu virus. And so they do not they're not taking the precautions that I think are necessary. And so I think that what we need to continue to do is be informed, to push out the factual information, make sure that people understand the consequences and what this virus is doing, and just make sure that everyone's educated and knows what steps and precautions that they can be taking, because ultimately the decision that I made and that I hope the people throughout Siouxland and our country make is that even if you feel healthy, you feel that you are not susceptible to this, your willingness to sacrifice and stay at home could very well save the lives of people that you know and people that you care about, whether it's close loved ones with a compromised immune system or those elderly people. You would be astonished, Sheila. I mean, myself as an extrovert and a very social person, I can think about the number of people I come in contact with throughout the day. So I had to take myself out of that equation. I had to make sure that I was not going to be a carrier, even if I wasn't susceptible to this. I need to make sure that I'm taking that step back. And so I would encourage people to stay educated and diligent during this time and make sure that they're not the ones that are contributing to the spread of this virus.
Do you think the state's taking enough steps to help prevent the spread or the severity of the illness?
You know, I would applaud certain steps that we are taking. I think that they are tasked with an extraordinarily difficult decision about what we can do and what we should do. I think that we made the right decision shutting down bars, restaurants, things like that, and ultimately even recently hair salons, tattoo parlors, different things like that, casinos. I think the shutting down of those areas was necessary. I think that sometimes people aren't taking this as seriously as they should, and so they're going to frequent those places and still expose individuals and take those unnecessary risks, even though I think that sometimes that's a really hard decision. I know that I'm thinking a lot about the people in our community that are employed in these establishments and doing everything that we can to keep them healthy and keep them open and able to keep employing those individuals. But I think that there are other ways that we can continue to step up as a state. I do worry about the number of test kits that are available. I want to see us proactively testing our population. I think that that's going to be important to really be able to gauge where we are at in this fight, especially as a state. I know there are some states that are being even more proactive than we are. And so I would call on the governor and our state delegation to continue to be as proactive as possible.
That's Sioux City Council member Alex Waters talking to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer, who's also in self-isolation after coming down with a respiratory illness last week. Well, the coronavirus is dealing a devastating blow to people in America and around the world, but it really can't compare with the deadly Spanish flu of 1918 and 1919. Jim Scopp has spoken eloquently about the scourge of the flu in one of his Small Wonders essays on Siouxland Public Media. So I asked Jim to compare what life was like during the Spanish flu outbreak to the world we live in now as we go through the coronavirus pandemic.
The working conditions, male, female, were just deplorable. They were much more difficult. People had to work harder and generally made less money for what they put in, no matter what occupation. People paid one-third of their income on food. That's much more than people do today. Home life was much more crowded because people couldn't live in an entire house with only one person or two people. Families were larger. 10% of infants died. 90% of the births that happened were outside of hospitals. So, you know, life was tougher in that way. Americans walked. They didn't take cars. Sometimes you could take streetcars, I suppose, but generally if you were going to go anywhere, you used a horse or you walked. And here, especially in Northwest Iowa, there were just scads more people on the land. Families were bigger, farms were much smaller, so any section of land would hold, you know, many more people than are here today. That is to say, of course, out in the country. So it was a lot different. And of course, the real focus of life was, how close is America going to be to this war that's going on in Europe?
I'm wondering what it was like to be ill
Because I know when people got just regular illnesses like scarlet fever, things they didn't have any way of preventing in that time, people either survived it or they didn't. And I imagine with this kind of flu going on, I can't imagine the fear.
It must have been horrendous. It just must have been incredibly horrendous. Because all of the factors that we see presently, what's going on right now, they talk about flattening the curve. Well, the curve was incredibly spiked in October of 1918, when people just fell all over the place. There was no end to sickness and ultimately in death itself. That curve was just immense, almost unbelievable, really. Spanish flu was really, really immense. Worldwide, 50 million people died. In the U.S., 650,000 out of a population total of 100 million. So trying to translate that into contemporary numbers, it's the equivalent of over 2 million Americans dying out of 330 million of our population today, which would be like all of Nebraska and all of South Dakota. We're talking about incredible numbers. People claim that World War I took the lives of military and civilian of about 20 million people. But as I said before, the Spanish flu took somewhere close to 50 million people. So it's just amazing how many people died with respect to or as compared to the people who died in the war.
It is incredible. Those numbers seem so incredible because, you know, we look at these numbers from the coronavirus, the number of people affected, the number of people that died, and it's terrible that anyone has to die, but it would be hard to imagine, you know, the numbers that they had 100 years ago.
Yes, it really is. It's beyond imagination. I don't think people in 2020 can even imagine how much that occurred. Years and years ago already, 50 years ago, when we first moved to Northwest Iowa, I found this little cemetery out south of Ironton, Iowa, just in the northern edge of Plymouth County. And I walked out there, and I remember thinking how many graves here weren't children. And they were all about that time. I didn't even know anything about the Spanish flu at the time. Now, that was 50 years ago, and if you were to go to Union Dunkard Cemetery today, the only graves that are there, not only, but there are very few left anymore, and they don't as readily indicate how many children died. But at that time, it was immense, and I'm sure that's true of any cemetery anywhere in the region, in the state, in the nation, because there was that many people who died.
I remember reading stories about children who were left without parents. They'd be put on trains and sent across the country because they had no relatives where they lived. Children are just kind of set adrift.
And it's scary. In its first iteration, in its first months, it was particularly difficult, and it took a shot at people that they didn't forget, but there wasn't much death. And then it lapsed for several months throughout the summer of 1918, and then came back with this immense vengeance in October of 1918. And that's really when so many people died at that month. So that's a second round of the same disease, and then there was a third round also, but that wasn't quite as catastrophic as the one that was in right before the end of the First World War, October of 1918.
Do you think we're so much better off today? We have ways of treating people and saving people's lives, and yet you can't always get ahead of something like this, of a virus.
No one's got a crystal ball when it comes to what we're facing right now or what we're in right now. And while, you know, the president would really like to sort of end this thing in a way by Easter, there isn't anybody who can say, well, it's going to be over by whatever time. And when you contrast it with Spanish flu, and you realize that then it, you know, it sort of came back out of nowhere, after being gone in the summer of 1918, it's even after making more fearful. On the other hand, it's gone. But many of these deaths were among young people, traditionally the most healthy and the ones most able to recover. More than 125,000 young people died. We think, and it's generally thought that way of our present virus problem, that it will affect most deeply those people who are elderly and have already existing physical problems. But that really, really hit hard at the middle segment between 20 and 40 years old.
That was Jim Scott, author of many Small Wonders essays on Siouxland Public Media, talking about the effects of a global pandemic 100 years ago and today as we deal with the very persistent coronavirus. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients in 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancial.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. And support for Siouxland Public Media comes from listeners just like you and also from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks today to Tyler Brock from Siouxland District Health, to Gia Emery from the Blue Cafe, and Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith. I'm Mary Hartnett. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Stay safe. We will see you next week.
Thank you, Mary.